second case for oral argument this morning is in the matter of the discipline of Lance Russell. For the disciplinary board is Mr. Robert Freeburg, and for the respondent, Lance Russell, is Mr. Michael Sabers. And Mr. Russell, this is the one time where we usually invite clients to directly address the court. It's not mandatory, but it's off. That option is offered to you if you wish to exercise it. Let's see, Mr. Freeburg, I believe you go first, don't you? Okay, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Representative Russell, Mr. Sabers. The proceedings in this matter have been a bit unusual in view of the motions and intermediate objections that were filed to the board's initial findings and recommendations to the court. But nonetheless, it proceeded, and the upshot was that following the hearing in August before retired Justice Miller, he submitted his findings of fact, conclusions of law, and recommendation, which for the most part are consistent with and to some extent mirror those found by the disciplinary board. I think that the board's findings are well supported by the record. There was some mitigation on the part of the board, which were set forth in either at the tail end of the findings that the board made, and those certainly influenced the recommendation that the board made in terms of appropriate punishment or response to the misconduct that the board found. In the final analysis, I think that the gravamen of all of this was a genuine concern on the part of the board, and I think also reflected in the referee's findings about the release of the grand jury transcripts and about the attack, criticism of Judge Davis. But underlying all of that also is a deep concern about the manner in which Mr. Russell was influenced by those outside the system, Mr. Schott particularly, and Mr. Pattitz, who encouraged him to use his office as the state's attorney to further what certainly circumstantially appears to be a political agenda rather than the usual sort of law enforcement that a state's attorney ought to be looking after, ought to be using the grand jury for. And in his own testimony, Mr. Russell expressed the fact that some of this he did in order to protect his reputation and to defend himself against what he thought were unfair attacks. And with that, I think that's the best summary I can give you. And the record.
Can you address the due process complaints?
Pardon me?
Can you address those due process complaints that perhaps there was not enough specificity as to which subparagraph you were actually accusing him of?
Yes. That's not new in the jurisprudence of lawyer discipline. And there are a plethora of cases, and the most recent one I've read came from the United States District Court in Connecticut that points out that these proceedings, they're not a criminal proceeding. They're not even really a civil proceeding. They are a disciplinary proceeding. And that it's not only the rules themselves, but that it's also the experience and, interestingly enough, the lore of the profession, which informs a lawyer of what's going on in these proceedings, so that it is not akin to a criminal process. It is a professional activity by the courts to protect the integrity of the bar, the integrity of the justice system, and we as lawyers are charged to understand that and to be able to apply these rules, and arguments about vagueness or those sorts of things have never flown. Except, you know, there's always a case of someone who's just gone off the deep end, but that was not not what happened in this case at all. The second thing that I think is critical in all of this is that the disciplinary board, which was criticized in at least one of the pleadings that came in between all of this, for the fact that the member assigned to the case, its investigation, the fact that much of this material had, you know, been circulated among the board and submitted by the respondent in the meantime, the important thing is that the board makes no final decisions about this. That all rests with the Supreme Court. So, you know, to me at least, if, which I would deny, I think, on the part of the board in my experience with it, if there is any suggestion that because these members who are assigned to a case actually try to find out what's going on, if that somehow makes them render a decision that's not fair and forthright and based on the record, you folks will set that straight. Because the board can't suspend anyone, they cannot publicly censure anyone. So, to me at least, that argument is a hollow one.
What about the fact that it's not always been clear from reading the cases, but there's been some tension about what standard of review we employ in these cases. But I think it's fairly clear that the clearly erroneous standard applies to historical facts. And if that's the case, should we be giving deference if board members are doing their own investigation? That would not be permissible in a normal administrative hearing. And I understand the uniqueness of this. But if we are to give deference under that standard to factual matters, is there some due process tension there?
Justice Inter, I don't think so. As I have observed and participated in this process, a couple of things I would say are apparent. One is that the presumptions that of innocence or of no wrongdoing or of no violation of the rules is a strong one. And I think the board has consistently recognized that and honored that. The second thing is, occasionally we've had a board member recuse himself or herself because of either some personal involvement or knowledge about the particular activity that took place, or because of a relationship with either counsel or the respondent or something. So I don't think there's a danger that the investigation that the board conducts is going to prejudice a member. Finally, I don't recall ever having a board member refuse to recuse himself or herself if someone who was going to appear before the board had an objection. The other thing to remember is that when these complaints come in, the board doesn't know whether they're going to end up in some kind of public discipline or not. But as the court knows, if you look at the statistics each year, the majority of the complaints and the investigations that the board conducts do not ever reach a public level. Many are, if not frivolous, at least not substantial. Many are cases where the board engages in some activity to remediate the difficulty a lawyer may be having. All kinds of things. Limit their practice, get them a mentor, get them to a counselor if they're having problems with depression or drug or alcohol abuse, all of these things. So, you know, if we're going to say that this investigative process that the board does is going to poison the well, I think then we are going to have to go back to the drawing board and reassess the entire system. And I think we've done a pretty good job of making this work fairly. And the board, as I said earlier, always has the comfort to know that this will get reviewed by you. And in terms of deference, certainly if there is some concern about the facts presented by the board, you could send us back to do more. And we know that the final decision is yours. You're not bound by our recommendation. You can, or the referees, for that matter. You can do as you see fit under the
cases. Does the referee do a de novo?
Pardon me?
Is the referee's hearing a de novo on the historical facts?
In this case, the referee considered the board's record, the testimony presented at the referee's hearing. Now, the board did not present any additional testimony, but we had a stipulation from the respondent that if those witnesses were called back, their testimony would be the same as it was before the board.
Did you object at any time to any additional evidence brought forth by Mr. Russell in front of the referee?
I don't think so.
So if he wanted to retry the case in front of the referee, he could have done it.
He could have done it, and he didn't testify. I mean, from my view, the referee's hearing was essentially mitigation. You know, Mr. Fitzgerald testified about Mr. Russell's abilities and his secretaries, and of course, Mr. Schott showed up and gave us a little speech at the end of his testimony. But other than that, no, I don't think I objected to.
I have a follow-up question on how this works. That one of the members of the disciplinary board does investigation. Or did in this part, or in this case. Is that right?
Well, it's not always consistent, Justice Marion. Mm-hmm. The way it works is when the complaint comes in, Mr. Barnett has what is called kind of the summary judgment standard. If it's absolutely fully facetious, he sends it back. Otherwise, he rotates those complaints and assigns them out to one of the members of the board, excluding the lay member.
And that happened in this case.
Yes, it did.
One of the board members
Ms. Julius was the person to whom this was assigned.
So my question, did she then participate in the decision-making, the adjudication?
Yes.
Okay. Was that always the case as well?
Pardon me?
Is that usually the case as well, that the one who does the investigation also participates in the decision? Or do they sometimes step aside?
My memory, I don't think anyone has stepped aside because they were involved in the investigation. They don't always. Sometimes I do the investigation on my own. Sometimes the board member wants to, you know, assist in that. So I don't recall anyone saying, well, because I've looked at all of this, I'm going to be recused. If that's the case, then every board member is going to be in that predicament because they're all going to see these written complaints and responses that go back and forth. I think there were two or three of each in this particular case. So, you know, it's kind of the way it goes. And if that turns out to be, in your opinion, something that's unfair, or if you think the board member should not see anything prior to the time that the case comes in, we're going to have to reevaluate the system that we use.
Well, I think this goes to Justice Zinner's question to a certain extent is, what's the standard of review? I mean, are they more of an investigatory body entirely, and that the due process kicks in when they get a referee looking at it with new eyes? And you know, that, I don't know if we've ever addressed that or talked about it.
So. I don't know if I can, but I would just go back to what I said, that the board members do not take this responsibility lightly, and they don't prejudge what's going on.
Now you've had a chance, I assume, to review the record in front of the referee. The initial recommendation of the state bar was public censure. Is that still the recommendation today?
Yes, to the best. Yeah, the board did not instruct me to do otherwise.
All right. Okay. Anything further? If not, thank you, Ms. Freeberg. Mr. Sabers. Sure, that'd be fine.
What I found out in the last year is that representing an attorney in a disciplinary matter is unlike anything else in the law. It's not the adversarial litigation process that is standard in our practice. For instance, the matter that the court just heard earlier. It's to regulate our profession. It's to protect the public and to make sure that their faith in the system isn't faltered. The other difficulty is that an attorney is expected, this court expects an attorney to acknowledge when they have done something that is wrong. And I think it's important that the board found after watching Mr. Russell testify and to be subject to cross-examination by the members of the board, which was very powerful, that he acknowledged that he made poor decisions, poor judgment, and he did things that an attorney in this state licensed to practice by this court should not do. The balance I found myself in the struggle I found myself in Chief Justice Gilbertson, this balance comes out of your opinions in Ray Labrith, in Ray Reynolds, in Ray Eicher. Representing an attorney who wants to say, I made poor decisions, but everything alleged against me isn't true. And how do I sit here and show this court that oversees my license to practice law? How do I show them I get it? I get why I'm here today, while also saying, and the perfect example is in the original report that was generated here, there was an accusation that Mr. Russell, as an unethical prosecutor, had appeared ex parte in front of an inattentive judge, and this is the language verbatim from the report, I know it by heart, and pulled the wool over his eyes to receive and to obtain an order to release the grand jury transcript. Mr. Freeberg will acknowledge at the board hearing, we stipulated to the fact that that didn't happen. That doesn't exonerate anything. It doesn't mitigate anything. But it's that balance that you find yourself in a disciplinary case of saying, boy, did I do some things that I shouldn't have done. And for that, I understand that the court has all of the authority to do whatever it believes is appropriate, but still saying, so you don't get an opinion like Mr. Eicher that he just didn't understand he had done something that he shouldn't have done. Wholly unrepentant, I think, is the wording in that decision. It's a difficult balance. It's been one of the most difficult things that I've done. How do you raise a due process concern without criticizing the disciplinary board for a thankless job, for a difficult job that is incredibly time-consuming for them? There are some good things in this case, and I'll get to those. There are three statutes that I'd just like to briefly address. The first statute is 8.2A, and it's the criticism or the allegation of the press release. Mr. Russell issued a press release. At the original board hearing, 8.2A was not alleged by the board. It wasn't at issue. Mr. Russell was asked about that press release, and he said, it was a poor decision. It was a poor judgment. He'll tell you that again today. I shouldn't have issued it. But the question to him wasn't, was it false? Because there's a case from the United States Supreme Court, and I believe 1934, it's the Ruffalo case. And the genesis of 8.2A is that it has to be false. You can make a statement that is otherwise, for some other provision, still violative of the model rules of professional conduct, but is it false? The press release was a bad idea, but the facts and the circumstances presented in it aren't false. That was the testimony we presented. Mr. Fitzgerald, one of the longest-standing state's attorneys in the state of South Dakota, who also was involved. I know that Mr. Russell issued it, but Mr. Fitzgerald looked at the release and says, you know, whether or not I would have issued it, those facts are at least correct. The deputy, Mr. Russell's deputy, testified to the same thing. Again, poor decision, poor judgment, but whether it violates Rule 8.2A and that it was false is something that you take stipulated facts and you apply it to a conclusion of law, and I believe that's actually a de novo analysis. Facts to the law and whether it violated the law is for this court to determine, and especially in a disciplinary matter, that is the case. The second rule.
So you're saying there's no violation because it was true?
No, I'm not saying there was no violation of 8.2A. Was it detrimental to the administration of justice, for instance, under 8.4D? That's up to this court. It was a poor decision. It was a poor judgment. The second rule.
How much do you think that particular finding or conclusion had to do with the recommendation?
Quite a bit, Justice Meyer-Henry. If you look at conclusion of law, number 2 from Referee Miller, conclusion of law in his findings are that the issue of a public reprimand is appropriate simply based on a minimum of two things, the issuance of the press release and the posting of the grand jury transcript on his representative website. Those are the two specific instances of conduct quoted in conclusion of law number 2 in the referee's findings. The second rule is whether, and I believe it's
4.4A.
And 4.4A and 3.8 kind of dovetail into another. 4.4A says that an attorney in this state shall not do anything or shall not prosecute any matter that isn't supported by probable cause. Again, I'm offering this for mitigation purposes only, not to exonerate. What I'm saying is that there was a grand jury. As prosecutors know, you can either let an information out yourself. You can sign the information as the prosecutor, or you can submit it to a grand jury. Mr. Russell submitted it to a grand jury, and as Referee Miller acknowledged in his findings of fact, Mr. Russell did it because he knew there was going to be tension regardless, and he wanted the jury or a person on the grand jury to decide it. If you look at it, you had the Department of Revenue testify at the grand jury, the Department of Legislative Audit, you had some of the employees of the defendants testify at that grand jury, and ultimately the grand jury let out indictments. They did. They indicted. So was there probable cause to believe the crimes had been committed? Yes, as found by the grand jury. That dovetails, as I said, into 3.8A, which is the special responsibilities of a prosecutor. As a civil litigant, I don't do criminal law, but I understand that prosecutors wield a very powerful sword, and with any great power comes the responsibility that you don't abuse it. And we understand that. My client understands that. My clients read Eicher, Reynolds, Lapreth. And I guess the point that I would point out, again, in that balancing of poor judgment, poor decision, and you hate to use the word but because it's scary in these matters, was there probable cause? And specifically as it pertains to 3.8, it says, no attorney shall do anything without any other substantial purpose other than to oppress, harass, interfere with the rights of third persons. No other substantial purpose but to do that. And what's been alleged is that there was no other substantial purpose to bring this prosecution other than to harass, interfere. And again, what I would do is rely upon the fact that the grand jury heard the testimony of state officials, employees, two other golf course engineers who, you have the grand jury transcript. I didn't ever get to see it, but I know it's in there. And from the testimony, what I've heard is that those golf course engineers said, listen, the bill that was submitted to the city was not, you can't get there. There's about an $800,000.
That's not the issue today.
No, absolutely it's not. It's not.
Let's get to the issue.
The issue is whether there was a substantial purpose other than to annoy, harass, or interfere with the rights of third persons. And I would say that there was.
Now, I heard you through, you've used up 10 minutes, and I still want to give Mr. Russell some time.
Yep.
You keep using the word mitigation.
Yes.
The state bar has recommended the least onerous public form of discipline we can enter, which is a public censure.
Yes.
Based on the fact you are asking for mitigation and not arguing the facts per se, what is your position on the recommendation for public censure?
We've always believed that either a private censure, and at this point I understand that sometimes that can become irrelevant when you're this deep into
it. A little hard to pull it back, isn't it?
It is.
Okay.
You can't unring the bell. And that was one of the issues we raised in due process with whether the referee hearing should be confidential or not when that's the issue. And the other is, and I apologize, Your Honor, for not knowing the statute off the top of my head, but I think it's 16954. And I always said it was analogous to the equivalent of a suspended imposition of sentence on that, which is the court can impose any conditions it wants to make sure that these types of things do not reoccur. Because as you have stated in all of your opinions, the point is to protect the public and to make sure that repeat offenses do not occur. In my last, just closing seconds, what I would say is this isn't, it's not all bad. If you look at the record, Mr. Russell graduated from law school a year before I did. He took over the office of state's attorney as a young attorney and practiced for 8 years. He administered it, by all accounts, by the employees, even by the defense attorneys in this case, specifically one of them who did testify before the board. He testified, Mr. Russell was a hard-nosed prosecutor, but in his dealings with him, he believed him to be fair. His employees thought that. Mr. Fitzgerald, one of the longer-standing state's attorney in the state, spoke highly of Mr. Russell. All of that is found in Referee Miller's finding of fact number one. Again, for mitigation purposes, what we would say is he's been practicing for 11 years. This is his only complaint against him. This is the only time he's been before the board. And I would just close by saying, and I told the board this too, I don't know if this court cares much what my opinion is or what my thoughts are after having dealt with this for a year and a half, but if this court were to ask me, does your client get it? My answer would be, yes, he does.
Well, to me, that's an important answer because I think that went a long ways in at least the Dorothy and the Eichner decisions to where we arrived at protection of the public was we didn't think those folks got it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've made that, you made that clear in Eichner, and you also made that clear in Mr. Reynolds' case. One example I'd like to respond, I know you've written on due process, I've read that. The one due process issue, and again, it's that two-edged sword, because I'm not saying we're not accepting responsibility, but I was put in a position as an attorney. I wrote a letter to the board before the first hearing, and I said, you know, I'm in a position where I need to defend my client. I need to know what the specific charges are. Our statutes say that even at the board hearing, you're entitled to due process. Growing up, I was told two things. Call it the way you see it, and if it's worth doing, do it right. We call it a due process hearing at the board. I wrote to them and said, I'd like to know the nature of the charges and what I'm going to be expected as an attorney to respond to and what Mr. Russell is going to be asked to respond to. And the response is, there's a letter in the file that says, we'll go where the evidence leads. I don't believe that we'll go where the evidence leads is consistent with due process, which requires the nature of the charges to be identified and the opportunity to respond.
Assuming for the sake of argument that the process before the board was flawed, doesn't the process in front of the referee cure all that? He got due notice and a hearing there.
I understand, and Mr. Russell and I talked and thought about that a lot. The burden remains with the board throughout the process. When they wanted to put in the transcript from the first hearing and rest, I had an objection because I suppose could I have called all of the persons who were called by the board at the first hearing to testify? I could have, but when it's not my burden, I guess my focus was elsewhere. When the referee is simply given a transcript, certainly, you read the transcript just like the court does. I don't think you cure it. I don't think the ends justify the beginning. I think the due process issue is still there.
Now, your due process issue goes to that you didn't know which provision you were defending against.
Yes.
And also that the investigatory member participated in the decision.
That's right. And an example was one of the first lines of questionings from the chair, who had also had done the investigation, was a question of Mr. Russell about domestic issues in his home. And as far as we knew, it came out of left field, and I wasn't prepared.
But wait a minute. Came out of left field. Came out of a press release that your client submitted to the board in defense of the charge. That's where it came from.
The domestic issues did not arise out of what we submitted or what was added.
It was in a press release. Or it was not a press release. It was in a newspaper article.
Not identified, not provided. My client didn't talk about domestic issues affirmatively in the newspaper.
Well, it was in the newspaper, though.
Right. It had been alleged. And if that's going to be an allegation that I have to defend against Justice Severson, I'd like to know about it.
I'm saying, you're saying they brought it up. They didn't bring it up. He did.
I don't think he brought it up. Someone alleged he had done it in a newspaper article, but I think that's different than him bringing it up.
But he attached that to his response.
Because I believe it was the complainant who had made the allegation in the papers.
I'm not trying to jump in here, but we only got 4 minutes left. Mr. Russell, I'd really like to hear from you if you're willing to speak.
And I would answer any questions that you may have with me.
I have one question for you right out of the chute. You apparently have admitted the wrongdoing of the past charges or allegations or whatever. And you said also that part of your life is behind you. You're not going back there. You're not going to be a prosecutor again. Where does Lance Russell want to be in 5 years? Because we have to protect the public, and that, to me, is an important consideration.
You know, I frankly don't know. That's one of the things I have, my focus has been I didn't want to go out there, of course, and take on a whole bunch of clients, not knowing what the future might bring. I couldn't disclose this to a number of people, of course, as we're going through this process. And so, frankly, I don't know. I'm waiting, essentially, for the process to play itself out, for you folks to do your job, and then at that point, I'll make a decision where I'm going from here. I had already started an LLM. I've completed an LLM at the University of Denver in the interim here, but it's all been while I've been, you know, going through this process. And so it's very difficult for me to say where I want to be or what I want to do. And I haven't opened a practice. I haven't been taking on, I haven't asked to be put on the criminal defense for, you know, the county or anything of that nature, because it's just very difficult. I don't want to be in the situation where I'm trying to explain to everybody, my clients, why I didn't tell them along the way what was going on, et cetera. Sorry.
Mr. Russell, getting the bottom line, are you acknowledging that your actions in front of the grand jury, particularly with Mr. Schott and his involvement and the release of the transcript, was an error?
I have said that.
Well, are you today? That's what I want.
Am I today acknowledging that I shouldn't have put the grand jury website or the grand jury transcript on the website? Yes, I am. Did I believe that I had a good faith basis based upon the order at the time? Yes, I did, because the order said that it was a public record. In hindsight, as I look at the case law from around the country, I certainly understand that it was an error to do so. Yes.
What about the conduct of the grand jury?
The conduct of the grand jury, as it relates to Mr. Schott, Your Honor, I do understand the concern. What I want to tell you is that everything that I did, I believe that I was doing in good faith.
I'm talking about today. Are you acknowledging that it was an error?
I do acknowledge that, yes, some of the things that Mr. Schott had done were problematic, and there was error there, and that I should have been more aggressive. And I acknowledge that before the board.
Well, we're a court, not a board.
And I do today, yes, the same acknowledgement that I made before the board.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question, but yes.
All right. You got about a minute left. You have a summary or something you really want us to know?
All I want you to know is that when I was going through this process, I understand that issuing the press release was bad judgment, and it didn't help anything, and I understand that. I also understand the concern that the court has as it relates to how the grand jury operated, et cetera. I did the best that I could with the resources that I had in the county. I had three experts. I didn't just have one. And I did the best that I could in terms of the interpretation of the law and the way in which I went about doing my job. Did I make some errors? Yes. I'm not going to suggest that I didn't. But did I do it with a ill motive or bad faith? No, I did not.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Freeberg, you have 10 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. I just want to point out briefly a couple of things that were mentioned in Mr. Saber's reply. First of all, with respect to the allegation about an ex-party contact with Judge Young, the board made no finding about that. That although that may have been in the initial complaint, obviously the board didn't have any evidence about that, and the board didn't make any finding of that had been a violation. Secondly, I don't think there's anything in the findings that suggests that the indictments that came out of the grand jury around the golf course project did not have elements that would provide probable cause. What concerned the board was the manner in which that was done, the apparent report that this was being leaked to the public, the involvement of Mr. Schott, and the circumstances of the final outcome. So, you know, circumstantially, it certainly appeared that this was motivated more by the political atmosphere going on in Hot Springs at the time, rather than any deep-seated concern about a loss of money or criminal conduct, since we know that state agencies were well into the process of investigating those things, and the city itself was in litigation to try to get the money aspects of that construction project straightened out. And underlying all of this is the concern about, as someone mentioned, the power of the prosecutor. I think that the board had a genuine concern, and part of its motivation for the recommendation for some public censure in this case was not only to remind Mr. Russell of his errors, but also to remind all of us in our profession that the prosecutor has a special role with a tremendous discretion to influence what's going on for good and hopefully not for ill. And in putting the context of all of this together with what Mr. Russell concedes happened, the board felt that this is something that required some kind of public response. I think that's the best I can say it, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Freeberg. Court will be in recess for tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.